Welcome to Business Second Opinion with Carol Sanford, a respected thought leader in the world of business design for growing people in order to grow your business. She always offers a contrarian view on what sacred temples of wisdom such as the Harvard Business Review advise. Her approach is based on living systems research and her four decades of practice with Fortune 500 companies and rockstar entrepreneurs. I'm Zach Swartout, and I'm your host. Today, Carol is giving a business second opinion on personality typing and typologies. She is going to be looking at the article, Pioneers, Drivers, Integrators, and Guardians by Suzanne M. Johnson-Vickberg and Kim Christfort from the March to April 2017 issue of the Harvard Business Review. Welcome, Carol.
Thanks, Zach.
So what are the premises of this article? Can we dig a little bit into that?
Yeah, this one is one of my favorite topics to what I sometimes call rail against, which is the premise they found it on, I find have lots of problems. But let's start with what the premise is, because typologies are really, really popular. So this one follows the kind of premises that most typologies have. First, they really believe that let me back up and say why people do this. I think that there is a rational decent intention, because we want to not treat people like machines or in a way that they're all the same. We definitely want to have some way to differentiate them. But it's so complicated for most people to be able to actually look at an individual, which is what I'm going to get us back to recommending, that we figure, well, let's get it into a certain number of types. You know, there's one that has 9 types. There's one that has 5 types. The most common one is something built off the Myers-Briggs, which is mentioned in this article, that is really basically 4 types that you just listed. Now, that means that the premise they're operating on is that people are categorizable if you can find some average that goes across all of them. So a second premise that then comes out of that is it'll make it easier for you to manage people if you can figure out what type they are. Now, you can allow for a little nuance, but for the most part, the premise includes not really paying much attention to the individuality, but to the type. As I said, I was shocked when a friend of mine introduced herself recently as a number on a typology, and she thought that would communicate to all of us who she was. We do need to know how to work with people, but the premise here is that you actually can do this with understanding a set of personality traits and preferences that provide generic patterns. And the assumption that underlies all of that, which is a part of the premise of this, is that human nature is fixed at birth, and personality types are a way of understanding what that fixedness was when we were born. And individuality feels like it'd be too often many different places, and so we want some way to get a handle on the different types. The thing I did also find interesting about this article, since I write and think a lot about diversity and inclusion also, was they were thinking that if you could just figure out when you put together a team how to get all 4 types on there, you would by definition have diversity. I can't go that far, mostly because I don't believe in types. So there's what the fundamental premises are. There's only one other thing that's probably important, which is why bother to do a new one since there are already so many. And I think part of it is trying to do brand building. But their belief was that most typologies require introspection from people. Take a test, answer the questions, and then from answering this set of questions, there will be an algorithm that analyzes and gives you back who you are. They believe that this categorizing of traits and personality characteristics that people have in the workplace gives you somehow an objective view. I never did figure that out, but that certainly is something they claim.
Got it. Okay. And so I think I get a sense for where you're going with this, but what are some concerns that you have specifically with this article and how they're kind of re-engineering the Myers-Briggs personality test in order to kind of develop these new typologies and with typologies in general?
Well, they're based on a lot of fundamental errors. And I think I wrote my first article on typologies about 35 years ago. And it was based on what I saw is a fundamental error, which is that it's possible to have these assessments that actually can use a mathematical model, and it can be accurate on predicting who it is that fits in what category. They are filled with unexamined assumptions, bias, and myths. Now, I got really excited when Harvard School of Business, Todd Rose, produced a book last year called The End of Average, which mathematically proved from research over a couple of decades that it was not possible to do that, that people are too what he called jagged. There was no algorithm that could actually give you without flattening out the individuality. And so the entire fundamental basis of all typologies is flawed in that it doesn't exist. It cannot be proven. And the typologies that I finally went back and looked at after reading his, I would look for where's the basis, and they would go back to another typology. Like they would go back to C.G. Jung and his archetypes, or some will build off of the Myers-Briggs. So they're building off of kind of metaphorical or symbolic association with a previous one. That is a fairly significant problem. The second thing is that they're using personality as a characteristic that defines everything. And to me, it is missing. And actually, the work at Harvard School of Business said the same thing. They call it obliterating individuality for the sake of simplicity, which is artificial. I call it, it is like obliterating essence. Now, essence, you could call it something else if you want, but I find the term accurate in the same sense that I can see the essence of a rose. I can tell that it's different than a gardenia and other things. And even one rose to another, even on the same bush, you begin to be able to see what's the essence of each one. But where it really matters is inside of a, well, with individuals, with a child, if you see their essence compared to how they're like all other children, you're more likely to bring out and develop who that child could be, wants to be, is aspiring to be, rather than trying to say, be more like your brother or being average in the classroom that you're in. So that's how they were looking at an education. Now, how does that relate to business? So my concern here is that businesses do a similar kind of thing in that they'll get typologies for a business, but it doesn't allow them to really do innovative, disruptive, strategic thinking. In DuPont, we went back and did the essence for EI DuPont, who was the founder. We changed the kind of product offerings that they could develop by knowing that the real core of EI DuPont 200 and almost 10 years ago now was his essence was managing risk. He had done that in the work that he had done as a nobleman for the last ruling king before the French Revolution in France. He came to the U.S. and he brought that into Connecticut. He built dynamite factories, but he made sure that people weren't injured. When we actually, with Chad Holliday, brought forward this clarity about what essence is of the company, it enlivens the ability to see what else you could do. And you start to see that you could, where is managing risk necessary? Well, it's sustainable fishing, because right now we just had another release where fish got loose that are genetically modified and can create all sorts of problems in the Northwest. But the same thing is true. What else needs safety? Well, there are this managing of risk. It allows creativity to happen. So I have a lot of concern when you do it at the level of a business or at the level of individual that you lose the essence. Now, what does that imply? That means that then you don't have individuals contributing. You don't have them starting with the customer. You tend to have people internally look at who they are as a part of a class or a box of people, and you have managers relating to them as one of a type. So those are some of the things that worry me. And I find that, you know, they're what I call class one errors to lose the individuality and the essence, to put people in a box and have them start to describe and introduce themselves out of that box, to manage people in that box. The difference is that now what you do is you have four boxes that people can be in, or nine if you use a different type of topology. So there's my concerns.
God, yeah, thank you for that. That was detailed. And so I want to take us back even further kind of and dig into the roots of this. And I think you started to speak to it, but where did the idea of a typology of personality as a concept come from? And why did whoever bothered to do this bother to create it at all?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. A lot of the practices we have today are really old. This particular one, I cannot find anyone trying to do this kind of organizing by type until the Swiss psychologist C.C. Jung, which many people know. He was a student of Freud's and later in a collaborator and then later an enemy of sorts. He grew up in a family which kind of set him on this track. His mother was very interested in kind of consciousness and particularly collective consciousness. Was there something that was kind of supernatural and moved people collectively because of how they saw the world together? Jung went to some of these events, tried to take notes, and then as he got older, began to reject some of it, but he kept the strong supernatural view. Then when he started to really disagree with Freud, what they were disagreeing over was what really began to open this door for him, because they were studying together what was the source of personality. And Freud, as most people know, thought it was based on libido and sexual drive. And Jung said, no, that can't be. And drawing on his mother's influence, he said, I think there's some kind of collective consciousness. And it would help me understand why it is that Freud and others I'm disagreeing with are seeing it so differently. There must be something behind why we keep interpreting this idea of personality differently. And he felt like if he could create a framework that could show this collective unconscious, it would help. And he created something called archetypes. Now, archetypes were spiritual energies to him that manifest at different times in different people. They weren't a way of defining particular people, but very quickly, he could see in his way of describing it that there were different worldviews. And he described these as being different personas. Now, persona is actually a Greek word for sounding the sona through a mask. So that's very interesting. But he knew that personality was a mask. It was not us, but the personality we had in the world was this sounding through a mask. And he felt like that it was not us, but people adopted quickly. He was alive till 1965, and he really promoted this idea of the archetypes. But there were people who wanted it to be a little more refined and specific, particularly the Myers-Briggs folks. They dropped out the spiritual part, made it much more behavioral by looking at how people behaved. I think there's one other historical piece which would be interesting to people here. So if you think about the time frame that Jung was alive in the early 1900s and his archetypal energy was really trying to help individuate people and help them see the mask they were wearing that was covering them up, not put them in a class of personas. But he was running in parallel with another major influencer of this world of psychology, and that was John Watson, who was at Johns Hopkins University. He thought you couldn't study consciousness. So here we have Jung studying consciousness and Watson in the same window of time saying, you can't study consciousness because you can't see it. You can only study what you could see. So you had these two schools of thought, which were running in parallel, one headed much more toward what we call the human potential movement now, the Jung world, and one headed toward the behavioral world. And the behavioral world, because it was more specific and seemed concrete and was artificially constructed as being accurate without any testing. It just came out of this lab that John Watson created in order to give corporate managers the ability to control people, to manipulate them. You got these two running, and now we have them colliding in something called typologies, some of which are more spiritually based, coming off the Jungian model, and some of which are really a combination of that and behavioral. So knowing that should make you really question when somebody asks you to do a typology behavioral assessment, and knowing there is zero research, and in fact, what research show that they really exist, but there is research showing they don't exist. So really worth questioning.
Got it. So let's say that I'm a manager and I put aside personality tests and typologies and all these kind of things. How do you come to understand people if not by a personality test? What do I use instead?
That's always the question. People get really upset. How am I going to understand every individual? You mean I have to actually be present with an individual person? Well, there are several things that I've done over the years, which is to first say, you don't have to define a box for them or even a name for them. I do sometimes help people get a candidate name, I call, so that they have a way to hang on to something that might be called their essence. But what you really want to do is get individuals connected to something much greater, which is like the marketplace, like customers, like stakeholders. And then here's the hint. Here's the question you ask that allows essence to show up without you having to figure out what it is. You say, what would you like to contribute to this market change, this initiative, this endeavor that we're going to do? And I'm talking about people who are down in the operation, not just people who are in the marketing department. You ask, where do people think they could contribute? Where do they get excited? Where do they feel like there's something they can see that really needs doing, but they need to grow themselves to do it? And that sounds like, I mean, it takes a little more to create the context for that, like it has to be tied to strategy. But that question alone would undermine many of the toxic practices that we have, where we're trying to ameliorate all the problems we have with feeling like we have too many individuals to understand, and go back to actually paying attention to an individual. So that would mean we'd end up also getting rid of tons of toxic practices, like the list of competencies everybody's supposed to fit in, which is not quite a topology, but it's similar when you talk about traits. So you have to start in everything with the individual. And again, Todd Rose in The End of Average gives a bit more about how to do this. We certainly do in my book. I've got tons more of the details and give stories of how we've done it in companies for 40 something years. So there's the hint. Start with the individual, drive everything from the individual, and let individuals step forward rather than you trying to define them. Remove that external system of defining who they are.
We'll be right back. I want to remind everyone about how to participate in the show by joining in our quiz on SurveyMonkey each week. It's here that you can offer articles for review from HBR or other popular business-written media, or you can also search for Business Second Opinion if you want to be able to try to locate that. It's more fun to listen when you participate. To get educated about Carol's approach to critiquing popular ideas, download her chapter at www.businesssecondopinion.com. Plus, there's a weekly drawing for a free copy of Carol's new book, The Regenerative Business. For all those who participate in the quiz, write comments or article recommendations, and Carol's going to give a shout out to those who get it mostly right. So, Carol, I have some questions, once again, from subscribers, and I have some for myself as well, if you have some time to help us with those.
You betcha. I love the questions.
Okay, great. You know, it's interesting you were talking about your friend who kind of named herself in a personality type. I'm kind of going to play the devil's advocate here a little bit and say, you know, speak up for those people who say, these tests help me. They've helped me in some way. They've given me something to hold on to in conversation. I feel like I can understand my partner more or understand people on my team more. So what's the harm in doing a little personality typology? What's the big deal?
I think we need to start with why people are hungry for that. There have been, over the decades, many research that shows what can you put on the cover of a woman's magazine. They mostly were, but I suspect it translates over to men's magazines, that would make that magazine fly off the shelves, that people would buy it. And they found that the thing they put on there is asking what type you are. And it can be everything from lover to parent, because people are hungry to understand themselves. And in our culture, people have been taught from school, categorized, to family, compared to siblings, to business, where you have to take a test to get hired. They have been taught that the way you understand yourself is relative to others. So there's a hint about why it's a bit of a problem to do it. But the other thing that happens is it certainly did feel better for people to be able to define themselves, because they had a void, kind of a chaos before, to have these typologies. And so I must be really cruel trying to take that away, right? But the enemy of really finding out who you are is finding out what category of what you're like other people really is. So it limits the ability of actually to understand your essence. And so my new book I was writing because I feel like work systems have to change. Parenting, education, all of those systems, the way we design it, need to change. And that's the kind of work I've been doing for decades. So redefining the way you go about understanding yourself to move away from a topology into a self-specific understanding based on, there's a couple of hints here about how you can do that. One is you actually look at the crisis or challenging times in your life and what part of you rose up to help you move through that. And there'll be a process in there that is the pattern for you. There's no universal process, but there's a pattern for you that rises up every time there's a challenge in your life. And beginning to ask that will be a hint toward essence. So what you have to do, though, is stop the putting yourself in a box as one of four types, or else that's what you see. It literally is a worldview that limits your ability to get in touch with essence. That's why I'm concerned that when people say to me, but I learned so much, they don't. They actually don't. They're learning something about somebody's algorithm or that they fit into.
Got it. So this leads me to my next question. I think you started to touch on this and you also touched on it earlier. So I see what you're saying around the value of essence of an organization in terms of its own kind of uniqueness and distinctiveness in a marketplace. But help me to understand from a manager's perspective why I should care about the essence and uniqueness of a staff person or an employee or those kind of things. And why does that matter to the bottom line to me?
That's a great question. We all know that at some level, the way we really get innovation is when somebody sees something they can do that somebody will let them do, or they can figure out a way to overcome the obstacles to do, that they step forward and say, I want to take that on. That's the way every entrepreneur, whoever created a great business, whether it's Steve Jobs or Larry Page and Sergey Brin or Henry Ford, what happened is people saw something because of who they were uniquely and then went after it. You can do exactly the same thing inside of a business where individuals, if you create a kind of system design that people can see, and particularly not just internally what they can do to make the company run better, although, you know, that's not horrible either. But what really you get your money back for every person you hired and every development set you put in is to get them all directly connected to markets, to customers. I put people on what I call field teams, and the field is they are a part of a community of people which are really looking at particular customers or customer sets. And each person on that team is saying, here's what I see. Here's what I think we need to work on. You don't get that unless you honor that each individual uniquely is going to see something different from the essence of who they are. So the return on every employee you have is paid off 100 times over. That's what I call enlightened disruption. You really have people who are a light comes on, and we do the same thing, or you have to do the same thing for seeing that kind of unique essence of each customer and customer set that you're going to work with, what makes them unique. And then you bring those together and suddenly you have true innovation happening rather than a marketing team or an R&D team who goes off and does it somewhere. You can have 100% of the people in the organization generating that kind of disruption.
Got it. And we have one last question here. And so I want to try to draw the distinction a little bit. And we've talked a lot about the origins of the personality test and then how that came from archetypes. So if I were to properly use archetypes, how would I start to think about that? Or how would I be able to kind of hold myself as I'm looking at an archetype? And how would that serve me? Because it sounds like there's some validity and some use to archetypes versus these personality tests. So I'm just playing with that idea.
Sure. Of course, I wrote a book called The Responsible Entrepreneur that's based on 4 Native American archetypes. And I can tell you what Jung says about using archetypes. And I can tell you what my great-great-grandfather said about it, and that came down to me and my grandmother, which is archetypes are cultural organizing of people who take on roles, but they particularly are the kind of roles you need when you have to do something that is for the collective, something that is for the whole. And if you look at what my grandfather called the energies that need to be at work, so let's take the ones that people might know, the archetypes of a warrior, a clown, a headman or a headwoman, and a hunter. Now, a hunter obviously is a physical thing, but as an archetype, it meant caring for the health and vitality of not only the people in the tribe, but also the lands and the animals that become food for it. The clown we also know as the court jester. Now, you could need to be either or both of those in any period of time. So you are not one of those as a type. It gives you, I call it a mantle you can put on. So you say, and I do this. I say, say, I'm watching what's going on here, and it needs head woman energy. It doesn't need a warrior, and I have a lot of warrior in me, so I have to watch which archetype that I've been socially conditioned within the collective, what Jung's mother would have called the collective unconscious. I've been socialized to operate much more as a warrior, but that's more like patterning, that conditioning that's happened. And when I know I need to step into a stronger role that's asking the question, what's good for the whole? How does the whole of the community that I'm in or I'm working with right now need to think? And can I offer a way to think about it? Not the answer, because the archetype is not me doing something. It's me providing a role. I mean, my grandfather taught me this because he is descendant of Mohawk peoples, and there was much destruction among Native peoples in the world. They brought back these archetypes in the late 1800s and early 1900s and used them to rebuild a nation of people. Jung said the same thing. I mean, I see people saying, well, they're using Jung's typology, but I think he would have rolled over in his grave because he was working to help people see their persona. Remember, that is the mask that we wear, that we sound through, we speak through that mask, but it is not who we are. But we may need to put on, like on a stage, we're playing not a role in that we don't let our true essence shine through, but in the way that we can see, if I tried it this way from this archetype, or I tried it from this one, what might happen? So there's a lot of value if you back up and see yourselves in developmental roles, but not when you lock you into one box in a typology.
Carol, I feel like I'm really enjoying our conversations. I feel like I learn so much from you every time I dig into these. So I really appreciate you taking the time with us today.
My pleasure.
Do you want to suggest articles for Carol to review, pose questions for her to answer, or argue with her response and get a second opinion? Become a member at www.businesssecondopinion.com. Subscribe and review this podcast and win a copy of the book or poster of readers' favorite quotes from the book. Also, subscribe to the blog that accompanies the podcast and newsletter that keeps you up to speed on what's coming next. Join us next Thursday, where Carol's going to do a deep dive into high-performing teams, team dynamics, and psychological safety from Harvard Business Review. Thanks so much for joining us. This has been Business Second Opinion.